Man, there's a lot going on today. There's a lot going on this morning. There has been a lot go on this week. A couple things this morning I want to hit real quick. And if I could bug Stephen, the slides on the first song, will you pull one up for me? I can't remember. I never can remember the names of the songs or the words that we sing. One of the slides, Justin was talking about praising God with your whole heart, with your everything, something like that. We're now for months. Hitting these moments, my hope is that, I was even thinking this morning, you know, some of the things that we do to grieve. Job, in the first chapter, he goes through all of this stuff, and he starts to bring about physical signs of his grief. Friends, I think one of the things that we're dealing with in our culture on repeat is that you and I are not allowed to grieve properly. What are one of the things that children do now that when they're stressed? What's one of the things that they do that everybody is just absolutely worried about? Cutting. Heard of that? What is that? It's a physical manifestation of a soul pain that can't be laid out. Like, man, this is horrible. It absolutely is. Job didn't do the same thing, but what did they do in the Old Testament to show their grief? They dressed in sackcloth and ash. They shaved their head, their beards. They did physical things to show, to represent an internal pain that had to have some outlet. So we've talked for grief about months, and I hope you all have not wasted it by not thinking this didn't apply to you. And God, I hope so. I hope it doesn't apply to you right now, but tomorrow may be different. Tomorrow you need to have some of these tools. A week from now you need to have some of these tools. Your friends right now need you to help navigate them through some of these tools so we can see the grief, so we can dive into that with them and to love them well, so that we can have wisdom in the moments to interact with them and not say something dumb, not say something useless. God has a plan. Like, dude, I just got off the phone getting the worst news ever, and that was what you come with? It'll all work out. Her and I were laughing this week. I'll send some good vibes. I ain't never felt a vibe, ever. Especially over the internet. Sending good vibes. Thanks. How about you send $5? That would do more. I don't need good vibes. Send me $5. Or pray for me. That actually does something. Lessons in grief. You and I today are going to deal with reality. We're going to deal with, today is an apologetic sermon. Apologetics, reasons to believe. Job chapter 21 presses one of the greatest hindrances to the gospel the world has ever produced. This is one of the things that if you bring up a gospel conversation and you talk about the God of the universe, somebody's going to look at you and say, there's too much. There can't be a God. It's too much evil. You turned on the news in the last 10 minutes? You talked to a friend? What do you mean there's a all good God, all loving, all powerful? That is insane. It makes no sense. Look around. Open your eyes. This is the number one rebuttal to the idea of Christianity. Is there an answer for it, is my question to you. Is there an answer for this idea that the world we live in is so broken, so evil, so wrong, and yet you and I believe, say we believe, put our life in the hands of this benevolent, loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God of the universe? Can you make sense of those two things? Good Christian thinkers have for years. Many people that never took the time to diagnose anything have not. They've never took the time to even think about it. Most of us would rather be oblivious than actually living in the world as it is. You ever heard of a monastery? What is that idea? I'm just going to escape it all. I'm just going to run from it. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want it to get on me. That's not living the life. Jesus didn't come and segregate himself from the world. He came and what? Right into the heart. Dare we even say the belly of the beast. Right into the grave. All of it. Face first. Brow down. in victory, in glory. Finish it for me. Why do bad things happen to good people? So you and I, just like on a daily, every other day, I spent 2.5 hours yesterday and probably 4 gallons of sweat cleaning a vehicle. Look good. And then I opened the door this morning and said, I've made a tremendous mistake. Why do bad things happen to good people, Lord? Is that something that we would utter off in one of those moments? Some of us would. Depending on when I was at in my life, yeah, probably. But it's silly to say it that way. It's an inconvenience. It's washing your car and then it rains. You knew you were going to do it. You apologize to the guys when they come in at work this morning. Hey, listen, if it rains today, I'm sorry. I pretty much did it. Right? Like Elijah, I looked out and saw a little cloud and called the rain in, and it came. Why do bad things happen to good people? We say that sometimes in our mind or in our heart, in some middle of some of the craziest stuff, right? They got your order wrong at Hardee's, right? Man, Lord, what's going on? Why do bad things happen to good people? I've been great, I'm hungry, right? We do that stuff. Really puts it in perspective, though. Some of the phone calls we get, that really is a question that you and I think about. This person is wonderful. They are helpful, loving, and kind. What is going on, Lord? You turn on the news. I mean, they got a movie soaring through the charts right now that you and I would look at and say, Sound of Freedom, why do good things happen to these children? Now, here's my question. Is your Christianity big enough to deal with that? Or do we just avoid it like fools until it hits us in the face or until someone rebuts our faith with something like that? Is there an answer? If there's not, in your mind, in your heart, I'm begging you. Today we're not going to answer all those questions, but I am begging you, sort that out. Because if you are serious about your faith at all and you share it at all, this is going to come up. Or the next phone call, the next email, the next something, the next text message that you open is going to have something sitting there so blatant that you're going to look at it and you are really, not like idiot me looking at the rain coming, you're really going to look at it and say, why do good things happen? Or why do bad things happen to good people? And if you and I are really smart, we get to where we reverse it. You want to really protect your heart? You want to really push yourself into a place of worship? Why do good things happen to bad people? And chief of them is me. That's what Paul said, wasn't it? I'm the chief of sinners, and yet the Lord loves me. This question has pushed a whole leg of Christian apologetics. The word is theodicy. Theodicy is the vindication of divine goodness and providence in view of the existence of evil. Literally, the idea in the word is God is righteous. Even though I look around and I think otherwise, God is good, God is righteous. The word is theodicy. Merriam-Webster says the meaning of theodicy is defense of God's goodness and omnipotence in the view of the existence of evil. What is the defense of God's goodness? The defense of God's goodness is His character. Is His character good? Okay? The defense of omnipotence is all-powerful. Is He really all-powerful? Theodicy is the discipline that works through that. The Bible would tell us always be prepared to have an answer. What's our theodicy? Is there an argument? Can we make one in the midst of such tremendous evil? You and I are to form arguments in the light of peace and a calm heart. You cannot form these arguments, grab a hold of them, and start working through them when everything is in utter chaos. It's very hard to do that. You can't start in the hospital bed working through the idea of evil. You have to do it when your heart and your mind are clean and clear. This should be part of discipleship in general, for children, for young adults, for all of that. One of the first things your kids' professors are going to point to is evil in the world as to why your child's faith is useless. That's one of the first things they're going to go to. We need to be working through this idea with our young ones, preparing them for the world as it is, not sending them off as lambs to the slaughter. But first, what are the assumptions of this idea? I want to give you some assumptions real quick. God's goal is to do away with evil. Is that true or false? Well, it don't seem like it's working. So the timing is wrong or his power is off. Do you understand? The assumption is it's God's goal to do away with evil. That is true. Eventually. Is it right now? No, it's not right now. If it was, most of us in here wouldn't have made it to today. Human beings are better when they're not suffering. True or false? Mumble that. Oh, that's false. I'm sorry, Lord. I know it's false. I don't do good when I have it all right here. I'm healthy. My bank account's full. My fridge is full. And man, all of a sudden, I'm just getting a little arrogant or a little self-sufficient. I pray a little less. I talk a little more about my stuff. I like it a little more. I take a picture of it before it rains so I can just prove that I cleaned it. We don't do good. Look at Hollywood. Look at professional athletes. Look at DC. We do not do well when we have it all right here. So that assumption, the world's assumption is people are better when they're not suffering. History proves what? The exact opposite. You and I are better when we have a goal, a mission, a load. Mark Driscoll would say men are better, especially men are better. They drive like a pickup. They're better with a load. Put some responsibility on them and watch them work and watch them go. Sometimes that responsibility is in the form of suffering. You need to pick up a little extra and you need to get a little more helpful. The assumption is we're better off when we're not suffering. Human history says that is not true. It's not true for me, and it's not true for you. We can learn lessons while we're suffering, and we can have wonderful mountaintop experiences, but in order for the next lesson to come, most of the time, the valley has to come. The next level of God's goodness. The other assumption is this, that my sight is of the situation is complete and full. I told you this morning, we had a conversation with the Heist family over at the house, and looking at them, and the Lord, the Holy Spirit was just kind of speaking to me and gave me something, and just looked at him and said, listen, if the moment your trial started, God would have showed up and said, I'll give you whatever you want. What do you want? And they'd have said, I want my daughter back, whole and healthy. It'd have been that simple. And now, years later, how about your daughter and a son and ministry and position and reconciliation? How about my own salvation? How about my family put back together? How about being a part of a church that loves us dearly? You'd have missed all of that. Listen, the assumption that God doesn't know what he's doing because there's evil in the world is the assumption that you and I have full sight. I know exactly what's best for me, and I know exactly what's best for my wife and my children. If God would just do it my way, it would all be better. That's the assumption. That doesn't even take into account the layers of other people. The other one is this. Is God powerless? Is he careless? Is he wicked? Is he aloof? When you and I look at the world as it is and we do not have a proper theology on how to handle this, those are the only assumptions you have left. Why does the world seem to despise God? Because if the God we proclaim is real, that's what he comes across as to them. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the smarts. He's careless. He doesn't have the character. He's wicked. Or he just doesn't care. So those are the assumptions of the idea that the world would be better if it worked my way. Job 21, bad theology and the failure leads to failure and burnout. Read it with me. Then Job answered, pay close attention to my words. Let this be the conclusion you offer. Bear with me while I speak. I'm reading out of the Christian Standard Bible, which is also really good. I'm reading out of it this morning because I don't have my own Bible or my own socks. So, like I said, not enough coffee yesterday or Friday when I was getting ready for work, and too much this morning. So, as for me, verse 4, is my complaint against a human being? Then why shouldn't I be impatient? Look at verse 5 with me. Look at me and shudder. Put your hand over your mouth. When I think about it, I am terrified and my body trembles in horror. Why do the wicked continue to live? That's where we're going to start. Why do the wicked continue to live? I know. She's not the only one that feels that way. I'm sorry, baby. There's a bunch of people here right now just holding it in. Let it out, love. A response to short-sighted bad theology is what's brewing here. Remember, Job's friends, what are they telling him constantly? You're wrong, you're evil, you're false, you won't repent. If you would just do that, life would get better. That's not the way this works. This is the prosperity gospel 3,500 years ago. If you just do good things, God will give you good things. That's not how this works. If that's how this worked, Jesus' whole life was an absolute train wreck. Do you understand? Who did better things than him? There we go. The cheat sheet. No one. Say it. How hard was his life? And we only know about the last 3 years. We get a couple glimpses early on. But I tell you what, he was born into a family that was filled with shame. Because who was the only person that knew Mary was a virgin? Somebody say Mary. Mary. So he's born into that. His father dies young. We hear about him when Jesus is early teen, 12, 13 years old. We don't hear about him again. So when Jesus starts his ministry, he's lost his father. Mother's still there. We don't even know what's going on then. I bet he worked every day. Sweat, mashed his finger, bled, had to deal with his mean and nasty younger siblings, half-siblings, right? Had to deal with all that stuff. And then we get the last 3 years. You say, man, nobody has ever done more good than him, and yet his life was hard. So bad theology leads us into places that are not good places. The barrage has created verbalized comments that would never be made. And I called this morning as I was typing out my notes, a soul yelp. It's a soul yelp. You ever touch a dog and they're hurt? What do they do? Yelp and what? Snap. You're touching something. The barrage has come. You're wrong, you're false, you're evil. You've lost your children. That was your fault or their fault. We don't know which one. One of you was sinning. You've lost your stuff. That's because you're wicked. Your wife is mad at you, that's because you're horrible. Might be true, right? But all of these things have come together, and now what we get is a soul yelp. Look at verse 7 with me. Why do the wicked continue to live? Growing old and becoming powerful, their children are established while they are still alive, and their descendants before their eyes. Their homes are secure and free of fear. No rod from God strikes them. Like, what's he saying? Why are these wicked people prospering? Why are good things happening to bad people? Why do they seem to be totally free, totally strong? Their bulls breed without fail, verse 10. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They let their little ones run around like lambs. Their children skip about, verse 12, singing to the tambourine and lyre and rejoicing at the sound of the flute, verse 13. They spend their days in prosperity and go down to Sheol in peace. He would say, verses 8 to 13, their lives seem great. You see, you and I, we don't live in monasteries wrapped in bubble wrap with our heads in the dirt. You understand what I'm saying there? If you're going to live with real people and open your eyes and walk out your front door, you're going to land in one of these positions where you look around and say, wow, extreme wickedness is prospering. Wow, this person is wonderful and their life is really hard. What in the world is going on? We're going to live there. And if you're not, you're being selfish. You're not doing life with anybody else? Because it don't take long to look around and see somebody that needs your help. He's going to look around, and we're going to deal with the world as it is. You and I are not going to be safe in this world. We've had this conversation before. You and I are not safe. This is a harsh place to live. We've learned it on repeat over the years. This is a harsh place to live. You and I are not safe, but you are secure. Your life is held into the hands of God until the day comes that He wants to bring you home and meet Him. You are totally secure. There is nothing formed against you that will prosper. That's Romans 8. That is what you can see and what you cannot see. And he looks around and he says, man, their lives seem great. You see, if you and I walk out and we live this life, we're going to touch things and leave a mess. I don't want you to think about this is just about bad things that get poured out on you. That's the wrong way to look at this. That's second. What's the first thing about this you and I have to deal with? Why do I do evil things? Why am I wicked? What kind of mess am I making? So we're going to touch and leave a mark. We're going to touch and leave a mess. And in this world, you and I are going to be touched, and it'll also leave a mark. Verses 8 to 13, looks like the wicked gets to dodge all that. Look at verse 14 to 16 with me. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. What does the wicked say to the Lord? Leave us alone. We don't want to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what will we gain by pleading with him? But their prosperity is not of their own doing. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. What happens, verses 14 to 16? Their demeanor is rebellion and pride. The wicked's demeanor is rebellion and pride. I don't need God, and I don't care what he has to say. And you and I would go, like, if you're really serious about that, are you understanding what's going on? It's like, it's a miniature version of, I don't care what Dad says. Tell him, bring it. Right? That's what's going on. The pride, their rebellion, they're self-sufficient. They don't care what the Lord has to say. And you and I have to understand that that's the piece that's driving Job mad. All these wicked people just seem to be, their life is great. They get to rebel against God. I wanted to serve him. I wanted to love him. I wanted to do the things he wanted me to do. I was offering sacrifice for my children. And now look at me. They pushed it and his soul is yelping. Look at all these wicked people getting along. They look fine. Look at verse 17 with me. How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Does disaster come on them? Does he appropriate disaster, destruction in his anger? Are they like straw before the wind, like chaff a storm sweeps away? God reserves a person's punishment for his children. Let God repay the person himself so that he may know. Let his own eyes see his demise. Let him drink from the Almighty's wrath. Verse 21, for what does he care about his family once he is dead? Verse 17 to 21, they dodge their own punishment and pass it on to their children. Job is crying out right now. Look at verses 22 on. Can anyone teach God knowledge since he judges the exalted ones? One person dies in excellent health, completely secure and at ease. His body is well fed and his bones are full of marrow. Yet another person dies with a bitter soul, having never tasted prosperity, but both lie in the dust and worms cover them. I know your thoughts very well, the schemes by which you would wrong me. For you say, where now is the nobleman's house and where are the tents the wicked lived in? Have you never consulted those who travel the roads? Do you not accept their reports? Indeed, the evil person is spared from the day of disaster, rescued from the day of wrath. Who would denounce his behavior to his face? Who would repay him for what he has done? He is carried to the grave and someone keeps watch over his tomb. He's carried to the grave and they honor him. Like Job is all in this thing, from start to finish. The dirt on his grave is sweet to him. Everyone follows behind him, and those who go before him are without number. So how can you offer me such futile comfort? Your answers are deceptive. Calmly to the grave and honored in death. On the surface, this seems what? Say it. Be honest. Nobody wants to whisper wrong. Egregious. This is bad. You're free to do that. Whisper it. This seems wrong, God. This seems wrong, Lord. So what is God doing? What we see versus what we know. What do we know God is doing? In our minds and in our hearts, in the light of calm, in the light of a moment, you can gather your thoughts. You can work through these things. What are God's goals? Let's go through God's goals. Are you ready? To bring glory and honor to King Jesus. If you want the simplest one, there it is. To bring glory and honor to King Jesus. So why did Jesus have to suffer? Because he is the name now lifted above every name. He was perfect. He was powerful before. But our God came, took on flesh, suffered as we do, loves us enough to do it. We sung that song earlier. It said, took your shame. Took your shame on the cross. Friends, that should have been me and you stripped naked for the world to see. It should have been me and you pierced and hung, cursed at, hair pulled out. It should have been us. See, God's goal is to bring Jesus glory and honor. And he did that through the mess, not by circumventing it. That's the prayer in Gethsemane. Lord, if there is any other plan, give it now. If there is any other plan, God the Father, if there is any other plan, God, please give it to me now. It's getting ready to happen. I'm getting ready to be separated from you. I'm getting ready to be beaten. I'm getting ready to have the sin of all of those that would come. I'm getting ready to have their sin poured out on me. I'm getting ready to be separated from you for that 3 hours. I burn off that punishment. They're going to strip me naked and hang me up. The King of Glory. And you and I have a problem with suffering. We serve a God that partook. There's no other plan that brings the glory of King Jesus. What else does God want to do? He wants to bring about redemption and reconciliation to this world and the next one. Romans 8 says that the whole world is groaning, waiting for the sons and the daughter of man to be put back right with it. This world is ours, and it is waiting for you and I to take our rightful place, to bring it all back in. I remember having a buddy explain every time he saw a deer that was hit beside the road, it was his mental reminder that this world was messed up. One day there'll be none of that. No sickness, no pain. The lion will lie down with the lamb, the children with the viper. Whether you want to or not, you're going to have to hang out with one. Get your mind right now. What else does he want to do? He wants to adopt sinners and make them saints. He wants to actually make us Christians, little Christs. That's the goal of the Lord. So all of this chaos that you and I are going into, that all of the stuff that we're living through, is a way of bringing about that plan. That's the plan of God. He wants to bind things back together as they were in Eden and as they are in heaven right now. Doing the greatest good for the greatest number of people now and into eternity. And what else does God want to do? He's going to punish the wicked. The devil, his angels, those that die in their sin, those that die in rebellion to God, he's going to punish the wicked for what? His righteousness' sake and his glory, Romans 9. Who is big enough, who is wise enough, who is powerful enough to bring these things together corporately, individually, for a family, and within the church? And what does that plan look like? That plan looks like what you and I are living in. That plan looks like hard moments that bring us together, together with him and together with each other. God is smart enough, wise enough, powerful enough to pull it off. So our theodicy, our vindicating of God's goodness sounds like this. Stay humble. You don't have all the answers, neither do I. Neither does the person mad at God for allowing evil. They don't have the answers. Okay? Let me give you this one. Get aggressive. You see, the person that believes in God has to deal with evil. How about the person that just believes in random chance? Do they get to escape it? You see, secular reasoning can give you no reasons to be good, but it can give you 10 a day to be wicked. They don't get to dodge it either. What's the secular person do with evil? Well, sorry about your luck. What? That's the good vibe person. Like that opinion matters about as much as sending me good vibes. Sorry about your luck. Like their life is great and yours is sorry. What do you do with that? Why does the atheist get to escape that? Where's the hope? Have mercy. Let's just all run off a cliff. They get to escape it because we're not aggressive with the idea. Like we shudder and, oh my goodness, my God, I don't know what he's doing up there. I mean, sometimes he gets it right and sometimes he gets it wrong. I mean, he could do things a little better. He's just God. The atheist gets to dodge it. How about this one? Go long term. He's going to wipe away every tear, which means at one point in time, every failure, every sin, everything that you doled out and everything that's been doled out on you is going to be wiped away. Every miss gone, every failure gone, every horrible thing gone. The atheist gets to offer nothingness, fade off into oblivion. Well, that sounds horrible. He's going to collect our sorrows, correct our sorrows, and cancel their wounds forever. Sandlot. The ones laughing are old enough. forever. Look short. What's the evidence that these people are right in their assumption? What's the evidence that we're better off when it's easy? American culture? How's that going? Listen, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm 42. I am right now thinking to myself, my children would be better off. I can't think of any parents ever thought this, ever. Because of the culture, my children would be better off to be called as missionaries to another country. You think I'm kidding? Read the tea leaves. FBI raided a pastor's house, I think somewhere in Philadelphia. Might have been Pittsburgh. Same city. I mean, they're neighbors. Raided his house. 20 FBI agents. You know what his crime was a year earlier or more than a year? Standing on a sidewalk, singing hymns and praying for those that were walking into an abortion clinic. Story is, one of those people got pretty aggressive with his son. One of the people coming in got pretty aggressive with his son. What's dad do? Didn't hear anything about any physical violence, didn't hear anything, but he intervened. Over a year later, the FBI knocked on his door and arrested that guy after he had already been cleared. For the first generation in history, I am looking forward and saying my kids would be better off to go to another culture and live out their life serving the Lord somewhere else than to get ready to partake in the liberal hell that's coming our way. Some of you school teachers are already living through it. Can't say this, can't say that. You can't say five-year-olds are boys, six-year-olds are girls. Doctor walks in and asks you what you want to put on the birth certificate now. You don't think that's going to land us in a mess? Try telling somebody right now at your work that men and women should get married before sex, be the only ones that partake in that, and that that's the only thing God recognizes at a family, and let me know when you need help paying your rent. I mean, we're playing around like nothing's a big deal. Look short. What's the evidence we're better off when things are easy? And finally this, my friends, look up. Look up at your God. As they come this morning to play, that's my last thought. You look up at the Lord you serve. What did He do? He took on human flesh. He was born of woman. He lived 30 years in obscurity. Nobody knew His name. He lived 30 years in obscurity doing normal things. 90% of His life was doing normal things, and you and I are waiting around for something big to happen so we think we can serve the Lord. 90% of the Lord's life was done, taking care of His family, running a business, taking care of the needs of those around Him, loving people and serving God. And so many people in our culture are waiting for the platform, the pulpit, the YouTube page, the social media. 90% of the greatest man to ever live was done in obscurity. And then for 3 years, He changed the world. God took on human flesh so that He could suffer as we suffer. As they play this morning, you stand. Look up. You have good reasons as to why things are the way they are. You serve a good God that loves you dearly, and the world needs what you have to offer.